Ledger is a writing podcast and a frightful messenger from unformed realms of infinity beyond all nature as we know it. I'm your host, Austin Wilson. Welcome to the show this week. I'm joined by Vaughn A. Jackson and Stephanie Paris. They are the editors of the anthology Beyond the Bounds of Infinity, coming out July 10th, 2024 from Raw Dog Screaming Press. It's an anthology of H.P. Lovecraft-inspired fiction, specifically from marginalized groups. It was successfully kickstarted last year in 2023. And you can go pre-order it right now from Raw Dog Screaming Press's website. Maybe I said that already, but you definitely need to remember it. It's got a righteous cover. You're going to love it when you see it, so go check that out. Vaughn and Stephanie stopped by to talk about using Kickstarter in general, and specifically using Kickstarter for publishing, which is now, as mentioned in our interview, sort of a normal thing for small presses, self-publishers. It's something that you kind of have to contend with if you're going to be putting a book out and your name is not Knopf. Or, you know, one of those other big houses. So we definitely talk about that. We talk about the controversial and hard to parse history of who Lovecraft was as a person, which, as I mentioned in the show, he was a shithead. We talk about that. We also talk about how do you edit a story and not just turn it into a story that you, the editor, would have written? How do you keep the authorial voice there? We cover a lot of really cool stuff with editing. It's one of my favorite chats about editing I've gotten a chance to have. We even talk about titling stories, how hard it is, how fun it is, how maybe not fun it is. Definitely an interesting conversation. I'm super happy that they both got to stop by and chat with me about the book. As always, swing by my website as well, austinrwilson.com. Check out my work there. But also make sure you check out itch.io, where I'm posting chapters of my new story, Dynasty of Blood, which is also up now on drivethroughfiction.com. You can find all that stuff at linktree/AustinRWilson. It's a story set in the 1980s during the Satanic Panic, where I'm talking about a fictional TTRPG called Dynasty of Blood, the people who created it, people who are playing it, and all the crazy stuff that's happening in that weird time in the late 80s on into the early 90s. So check that stuff out. Make sure you like, rate the show, tell your friends about it, all that stuff. But specifically, make sure you go check out Beyond the Bounds of Infinity at Raw Dog Screaming Press. As for now, here's my chat with Vaughn and Stephanie. Kickstarter and other crowdfunding sites, but kind of Kickstarter in the lead position, is really starting to become like very important for publishing, both for independent presses, small presses, self-publishers even. And this book was successfully funded on Kickstarter in September of 2023, and now it's coming out July of this year. What I really want to know is, when did the like journey of this actually begin? Because I know how much work goes into a Kickstarter and how much work goes into putting a book together. So do you remember when this book actually started its journey to becoming Beyond the Bounds of Infinity?
Oh man.
First, I want to say thank you for having us on. We're really excited to be on this podcast. So
yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.
But I'm trying to remember what month it was. It was last year. But yeah, it was early last year. But Vaughn had been saying the Kickstarter tagline and kind of not the book's tagline, but thing has been make Lovecraft roll over in his grave.
Right. I was gonna ask about that.
That's been Vaughn's life motto for a while, I think. So
the idea, it was kind of an offhand comment that I made on a panel at StokerCon, actually. Where I was talking about how I don't like having my characters just sort of succumb to the cosmic horror. I like to have them fight back. I like to write characters that would make Lovecraft roll over in his grave. And that received a fair amount of cheers and applause from the audience and the panel, actually.
Yeah. Well, yeah, your Kickstarter comes, one of the tiers came with a pretty righteous sticker of Lovecraft rolling over in his grave. And I'm pretty sad I didn't get one. I didn't get a chance to pledge while the Kickstarter was running. It's a great sticker and a great concept, and I definitely want to dig into that further. Is that the sort of like beginning of what would become the anthology? Is just that that panel at StokerCon, or the idea of sort of subverting what Lovecraft was known. I mean, we will get to this. I have a lot of or some questions built around this, but the things that Lovecraft is known for at this point now, you know, it's not just cosmic horror. It is racism and horrific stuff. In my notes, I wrote that he was a pretty staunch shithead.
Pretty accurate.
Yeah. So
that's a really good way to put it.
Where, like, when the concept of getting together all of these voices that Lovecraft himself would not have gathered together, is that as far back as you can go? Last year, sometime, where you were like, we should do an anthology of this, or is it even further than that? I see Stephanie reacting.
It was further than that. But by StokerCon, we had already kind of thought about doing the Kickstarter. We had ideas for the Kickstarter. You mentioned the sticker for the Kickstarter. Our dear friend Micah Myers did a great job on the art for that. He's a really talented artist. We're so happy that he did it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It actually started a little bit before that. Vaughn had been saying that he would love to do an anthology of people that Lovecraft would have hated playing in cosmic horror. And I was like, I would love that too. And then we were talking go on.
No, I thought you were finished. Please go ahead.
Oh. I was saying we were talking to Jen about that, Jennifer Barnes at Raw Dog, about how cool would it be if we just kind of stuck it to Lovecraft in this way.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been reading cosmic horror for a while, and I've always kind of found it interesting that it wasn't until I was in college and came across Victor Laval's The Ballad of Black Tom that I, you know, read some cosmic horror that wasn't written by a racist white guy.
Right.
And I was like, man, I wish there was more of this. And so, I mean, so that idea has been kind of rattling around in my head. I think shortly before StokerCon, like Stephanie said, was more when the concrete idea of, like, let's just get a bunch of people together and make cosmic horror as diverse as possible. And also try and give these people who wouldn't normally have a chance to share their voice, the chance to share their voice in the genre. But I think the response that we got at StokerCon was kind of the very big, like, we're going to do this. Like, people want this. Like, this is the thing that people want.
Yeah. And when I saw the collection, I was like, I want that. I want to read that. And I let, you know, cosmic horror, that world, or just those creations that Lovecraft is a giant part of, is a thing that I really like. But then, yeah, reading about him. And also, as we were preparing for this, I saw a sticker on Stephanie's laptop that said, it's Lovecraft's gravestone. And it says, there's a sticker over his gravestone that says, we are Providence. Mm-hmm. I liked that gravestone a lot. There's a pride flag by it, as well as a Black Lives Matter flag. I like the sticker a lot. And I think it succinctly puts out a lot of the ideas that I am happy that the anthology is bringing forth. Rather than waiting to get to this question and all of this stuff later, let's get to it. We'll just go to it right now. Because he was such a staunch shithead, there's a lot of baggage that comes along with his creations. And the Kickstarter talks about bringing diversity and modern sensibilities to Lovecraft's legacy. And this is a really complex topic. There's a lot of hard stuff that we have to talk about with this. So if you would rather pass on this one, totally feel free to say that. I'm never going to be like, no, answer it. We can move on. The big thing for me, and I think for probably a lot of people, is you worry about supporting a person who is shithead and is known for horrific things. And I've talked about this a lot with some of my friends, and that line tends to be in different places for different people. So it's sort of a difficult thing to figure out, but I often wonder about that. Like, am I giving this person more attention than they deserve? Like, do we have to write about Lovecraft? Like, should we move past Lovecraft, or should we write, like, where do you guys fall on that scale as far as it? Does Lovecraft even deserve us? Or should that asshole just stay in the past? And like, I am very curious, just because I've heard so many different answers about these kinds of things. And I saw your anthology and I was like, yeah, I want to read all these stories. But I know it's a weird topic that some people don't have a quick answer for.
So I think that the way that I approach this is, I think that if you are going to exist in the space of creating cosmic horror, you should read Lovecraft. Not because I think that he is, you know, spectacular or the end all be all. I enjoy his stories for what they are, but he was a dry writer. He was a pretty dry writer. Everyone loves the things that he created. They love Cthulhu, Dagon, Yog-Sogoth, all that. But his writing itself is very terse. At the same time, because he is very much the inception point, or perhaps more accurately, the boom point, the big bang point of cosmic horror, it's important to know where the genre came from and also to see how it has been used to downtrod and oppress the marginalized groups that Lovecraft hated. And I think that you need to be able to look at it through that lens and see how you can repurpose what he did for the modern sensibility, how you can bring it up to speed. And, you know, one of the big things that we see a lot nowadays in modern cosmic horror is that the other that Lovecraft represented as always the antagonist, the scary thing that drives his cisgender white male character insane because, you know, he's related to fish people, is we see this this switch where the other, that marginalized, that horror, is actually the protagonist. They're the good guy. They're the people, and they're misunderstood, or they're not viewed correctly. I think that kind of take claiming that back, you know, almost like how certain communities claim back certain slurs, like reclaiming that horror of our marginalization, of our otherness. You can't do that without seeing how you were othered in the first place in the genre.
I also agree with Vaughn on that. I think typically it can be a lot easier for us to want to just forget about things and put them in the past. Luckily, Lovecraft does not make any money off of us buying his books right now. So it's a little bit easier than, say, modern writers who might still profit off of people buying their books or supporting their art who have less than stellar views. Sure. But it feels like a lot of tropes that if you don't know their origin, they can get perpetuated. And those tropes, mm-hmm. maybe you're a writer and you aren't thinking of the other as anything other than a scary fish monster. But if you don't have that knowledge of reading Lovecraft and knowing what the other really was symbolic of, then you're at harm of perpetuating that harmful stereotype and harmful tropes that might not necessarily be how you feel, but it is still perpetuating that. So I think, and that can go across plenty of different genres. We're talking about cosmic horror, but I think you need to know when you're writing, and even history in general, what those harmful things are in history so that you aren't in danger of perpetuating harmful stereotypes yourself.
Yeah, and I think an interesting kind of not necessarily horror example of that is, so recently a movie was released and then immediately was attempted to be scrubbed from the annals of history called the American Society of Magical Negroes, which ostensibly was meant to be a deconstruction of the trope. And it was so bad that it made black people and white people angry. And it was pulled from theaters after like a week and a half, 2 weeks. I myself have not seen it, but everywhere I have looked, people have been like, what were they trying to accomplish? And I personally think that probably the person didn't actually do their research on what that trope was, why it was harmful, and how you could deconstruct it. And as a weird aside, because I'm like this, but so they recently, I don't know how recently it actually was, but they changed the World Fantasy Award from a bust of Lovecraft's head to it's like a world tree type thing now, I think. And I understand why people wanted that to be done, but I was really disappointed because I had not yet, you know, I wasn't able to win one in the time because I wanted to have Lovecraft's bust on my writing desk where you just watch a black man write his shit.
That's right.
Every day.
Keep watching, Howard.
Yeah, right.
Here I am doing it.
Suck it, Howard.
Yeah.
I can probably buy a bust of Lovecraft.
Yeah, we can make
you
that
know, happen. I can probably find one. We can make that happen. There's an Etsy seller somewhere.
Yeah, I understand winning it. That's cool too.
Yeah, but I can just get you a bust.
I think all of that makes a lot of sense to me. Stephanie talking about knowing what you're going to be subverting. Vaughn, you talking about, even just the idea of being like, keep watching me do this, Howard. Like, it doesn't matter what you like. I thought about it a lot as I was preparing about. I mean, knowing the history of what he was and the things that he said and wrote and this struggle between like art and the creator, it feels almost that I think about it so much at this point that it kind of bores myself where I'm just like, am I gotta worry about this? Like, why can't I just figure out a like, but again, like I said at the beginning of all this, it's very complex, it changes, you know, person to person. But moving on from that a little bit, you're both editing this, you're both writers. I want to talk about editing specifically because I haven't really gotten a chance to talk a whole lot about editing, and I have a lot of interesting, like, well, I find them interesting, who knows if they are or not. I would love to know the differences between editing a collection for thematic coherence and editing a story. What similarities and differences or difficulties that it has between, like, okay, we're going to put together a collection. The form of editing that is a little broader and kind of abstract, but I think it's got weird interior mechanisms that people don't really think about a lot. So walk me through what that means first, the editing as far as putting together a thematic collection. What's that mean for both of you, and what's it looked like?
You can take this one first, Steph.
Okay. So there are definitely, like you said, it's editing stories and then editing for the collection. I know a lot of writers listen to your show, and I just want to put this out there. We did an open call, and I think before having to reject so many people, you get the rejection is like, oh, it wasn't a right fit. But it really wasn't a right fit. When they say that, they mean it. It's not just a line. So there were some stories that you have to look at it as a whole. And it's like, where would this have fit in between two other stories? And we loved the story, we loved the writing, but we couldn't have fit it in to what we were trying to do and what we were trying to go for. As we looked through the stories, we really found that we had kind of a microcosm of different cosmic horrors. So like, we have one in here that's like cozy cosmic horror, which I didn't know
that's awesome.
Was really a thing, but I love it.
Yeah.
Like a folk cosmic horror. Some are like true cosmic horrors, but we have a lot of different ways you can do cosmic horror and just the diversity within the genre itself. And so then we were kind of looking for that within the submissions, which wasn't something that we had necessarily set out for, but it was kind of just what we found we had. And so as we were looking through these submissions, it really was, obviously the writing had to be good, the story had to be good and all of that, but we wanted it to be also like, oh wait, this actually is kind of like diverse in a different way too, where who knew you had cozy cosmic horror and how cool is that? Like, but then yeah, editing this, oh. Yeah. Oh, go on.
No, I thought you were done again. You take long pauses.
Vaughn, you can go.
Oh, I was going to say that I think it was interesting that we had a theme, but they're like, it's a disjointed theme, and it was that way on purpose. You know, it is all cosmic horror, like Stephanie was saying, and there. But then within that, we do have the cozy, the folk, the sort of the more rebellious, the really, really out there. And so the stories that we didn't take were not so much that they didn't fit, but that they were so far out of the scope of what we were trying to fit that they didn't work. I mean, yeah. I think one of the stories that left Stephanie and I like the most uncomfortable, like definitely had that real like cosmic horror, like to it.
Yeah.
We didn't think it would fit because it was more erotic horror and that's not the vibe we were going for. Right. So it's interesting to see how a lot of sort of same thematics can hit just different notes.
Did you see or notice a almost like building a narrative, like a broader narrative? Like, did it feel like placing the stories in certain orders? Because that's, I've read about editors talking about like where the story hits in the anthology. Mm-hmm. It actually does have more effect on the reader than you think it does. Is that something that you saw yourself sculpting, like trying to create an almost like narrative arc as far as emotional beats, thematic beats of stories that would take readers from the beginning of the book to the end of the book?
We did. I actually think that we had almost as difficult of a time, if not more difficult of a time, ordering the stories than we did selecting them. And that's not to say that the selection process was easy.
Yeah.
It's just that we would be like, oh, we have this story here and this story here. And Stephanie would look at me and say, well, that's like 4 super emotional gut punches in a row. Maybe we should give the reader a chance to breathe.
Let them take a break.
And I was like, I guess we should. And then like, you know, we'd look and we'd be like, okay, well, we have these 4, you know, more suspenseful stories that kind of like creep up on you as opposed to gut punching you. And it's like, well, they're going to fall asleep. We need to bring them back. And so I do think that the way that we ended up organizing it, not so much a narrative arc, but more of an emotional pattern.
Yeah.
This sort of like, okay, and I think it kind of reflects how cosmic horror works, where it's like, you know, you have sort of, and I'm going to use the word mundane, but I don't mean that in a bad way here, but you have the more, the low key, and then you have the, holy shit, there are tentacles everywhere. And then you kind of have the falling action. And so you kind of have this almost roller coaster of emotion, I think, in our anthology. And I think one of the cool things, and I'm gonna toot my own horn because this is my idea. So the last story in our anthology is not written as a traditional type of story. It has an interesting way of handling itself, but it ends with what is actually a closing scene. And so as opposed to just being like the end of a story, it feels very final. It feels like a very good like bookend to all the stories. And so I was very insistent on having that story as the last one, because I felt like it was good. Like, okay, you get to that last part and you can close the book, and that's like, you know, that's done, scene over.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at the table of contents right now, and there were some, like, we knew what the first and last story we wanted, and we knew the middle story, because that was kind of, like, the peak of weird, almost.
Yeah.
And we also rated the stories on, like, how weird are they and how upsetting they were, were, like, emotionally heavy. And so then there were some that we paired together as, like, okay, this is really, really emotionally heavy, and then this one is like a lift up, like you, so you can kind of have that balance.
Yeah.
And then it was kind of like puzzle pieces, but it definitely, it was a lot. It was a lot of nights of, well, does this work together? Or what do you think of this? Or, oh, well, these are too thematically related. Should we put them back to back, or should we actually spread them out so it doesn't like get boring? Like, or not boring, but we don't want you to like go in. Oh, go on.
No, I keep doing this. I think that we were still changing the order around up until like, you know, the last minute before we sent the stories in order to Jen.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it's hard to, well, how many, do you know how many submissions you received when you did the open call?
Around
over 300.
Yeah, 300. Just I think a little over 300. Like, I think 320, it was closer 320.
I thought it was closer 400? To 400. I thought it? So, it but maybe I'm wrong.
I have the numbers 3, 2, and 8 in my head, so it might have been 382 or 328.
Well, so the, you sort of already mentioned it a little bit, Stephanie, about getting that response. You know, your story wasn't a good fit, and because you both write, did you have any moments where it was like, shit, we're going to be the people saying no, we're going to be sending those emails that we have to figure out how to word so that they don't get their, like, obviously you're not going to send something that would be actually like hurtful, but like, we know what it feels like when somebody says no to a story, and it can be a delicate thing. So how'd you navigate that path?
Do you want to take it first, or
a lot of stress?
I Googled around a lot to see how to write a short story rejection, or examples of short story rejections, examples of good ones and bad ones.
Yep.
It was just the two of us, and a lot of people were like, oh, you should try to do personal feedback if you can. And I was like, we definitely cannot do personal feedback. I feel bad, but we can't. And another, not issue, it was something great and something we're both really proud of, is we got a lot of people who have not been published before submitting. And a lot of people, this is their first time being published. Or, I don't know what a lot is. But there are some people,
there's six in the anthology.
Yeah. And that's something Vaughn and I are really proud of, but obviously that comes with people who have never been published before getting rejected. And I would never want to be the person who they were like, I got that rejection letter from Stephanie and Vaughn and I gave up writing forever because it was so bad. And so I actually sent it to a friend who is a writer, but she has also not been published and she hadn't submitted. And I was like, how does this sound? Does this sound okay? Like, how would you feel if you got this? You know, just to make sure, we want to encourage everyone. We don't want, it sucks there. We could not print 300 stories.
Yep. Well, I think even being in the position where you're worried about it, you're already ahead of some of the people who are out there sending rejection letters. Because if you're thinking about it and if you're searching, like, whatever you end up doing, like, you'll have those weird one-offs where somebody reads something with the wrong tone or context, or that they're just having a bad day or whatever. But my guess is there, none of your rejection letters hit anyone incorrectly or badly.
I think we had someone tell us that our rejection letter was one of the nicest ones they received.
This is good.
And I worry about that because it was pretty straightforward.
Like, straightforward. What are these people being told?
Yeah, like, what is being said to you? Do you need tea? Are you okay?
Yeah, that, I thought about the stress, well, just of the Kickstarter, even just running the Kickstarter, seeing responses, waiting for the pledges, and are we going to make it? Like, all of the things that I know come with it. And I've never run a Kickstarter, so really it's just sort of academic for me. I haven't gotten to experience it firsthand, but I'm sure it's hard to put it mildly.
I'm anti-Kickstarter now, but yeah. Not in a, like, not against Kickstarter, the platform. Not Kickstarter the platform. Kickstarter the platform was lovely. We got a, like, projects we love or whatever it's called. Like, they were great. It's just, it was my fault. I mistakenly thought the hard part would be choosing stories. And it was hard.
Sure.
But the most stressful part was the Kickstarter. It is just planning the Kickstarter and then running the Kickstarter. It's a full-time job. That's what they don't tell you.
So let's talk about that from the publishing standpoint. Editing a book, and like I sort of mentioned at the beginning of this, Kickstarter and other crowdfunding platforms have become sort of pretty big within the publishing realm, and the stress that comes along with that, on top of being stressed about whatever you're writing, whatever you're working on outside of that, so you said you had talked to Jen about this from Raw Dog Screaming Press, the publisher. Mm-hmm. And so was it always going to be a Kickstarter, and that was where it was going to begin? That's one of the things I think people don't understand now about sort of independent publishing or smaller publishing houses, is that it's not always that you get, like, even if you get the chance to talk to an editor and say, I have this idea, they're not going to be like, it's great, we're going to publish it.
Yeah.
It's not always that way. So was it all, like, the journey always included Kickstarter?
Yes. And the main reason for that, so we could have done it without a Kickstarter, but the reason that we did the Kickstarter is we wanted to be able to make sure that we could pay every author professional rates, make sure we paid our artists well. You know, we wanted to make sure that everyone was getting all of the compensation that they deserved for their efforts. And I mean, when you're asking for stories of, you know, 4,000 words cap, 8 cents a word starts adding up.
Yep.
And, you know, printing costs, shipping costs, although we did learn later on that Kickstarter does handle shipping for you or something, like, there's a way to put it into your pledge. Stephanie's shaking her head.
I was going to say, I see Stephanie shaking her head. No, that's wrong.
You can add it, you can make it so that they pledge and then they have to do shipping on top of that pledge.
Okay.
So what we did was basically, it was all free shipping. We didn't realize that we had a choice in doing free shipping or not, which was a Kickstarter.
But because of that, we ended up putting, like, the price a little bit higher to account for shipping. So, I mean, it was our first time. You live and you learn, and I'm sure people understand that, or they're waiting outside with torches and pitchforks now.
It's one or the other.
Yep, no in between.
Yeah, they got free shipping. There's no such thing as free shipping, right?
Right. Yeah, it's someone's, like, paying somewhere.
Yeah,
it's right there beside a free lunch.
Yep. Well, yeah. I think that's important to talk about, though, the paying the writers and paying the artists and making sure people get, and also knowing that you have 6 writers in the anthology who have never been published before, they're going to get paid for their story. That is a very big moment that's going to have a big impact on those writers. I don't know if it would be life-changing. That depends on the person, but that's such a big part of being a writer and feeling accepted and like you're doing the thing and that you're getting it. It's awesome. So that's very cool. And one of the reasons why Kickstarter, I think, as a model,
it is great. I take back what I said.
It's already in the internet, Stephanie.
Oh, I would never want to do it again. I'm probably going to, but I would never want to do it again.
That was another one of my questions. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I would take off work. I would, I don't know, book a vacation right after. I don't know what I would do, but it was a lot more stressful than I had anticipated it to be. And so I just looked back on that time like a blur of stress.
So the question of doing it again, because knowing, like I said, I haven't run one. I've pledged to a bunch of them, but with some of the projects that I want to do, I'm like in the back of my head, it's like, I'm going to eventually have to tackle that monster, and I know it's going to be stressful.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the cool things that Kickstarter allows you to do is if people backed one of your projects, when you go to do a new one, you can import that list and basically send out a thing that's like, hey, so you know how you gave us money for this other thing that we did? You want to give us money for a new thing?
And thing I think number
that
two.
Actually, yeah, and I think that actually makes the process easier because you have this huge chunk of people now who are going to see it immediately, as opposed to, you know, us getting on Twitter and me being like, if I pull up the leg of my pants, will you donate to the Kickstarter? Like, you know, flagging people down on the street and so on. You can just be like, hey, like, And generally speaking, people who back one Kickstarter are more likely to back another one. So I think that, so also I'm gonna kind of argue with Stephanie here. I actually wasn't super stressed about the Kickstarter.
Next time I'll get you to do the cold emails then.
I didn't ask you to do that. You did that on your own. I was like, you know, if we make it, we make it. If we don't, we don't. And I mean, if we hadn't made it, I was fully willing to wait a little bit, come back, try it again, you know, reassess how we went about it. But I do think that whatever stress Stephanie was dealing with, and the little bit that I felt more towards the end when it was like, please just let the number go up over the one we need. I'm hoping that having the established list of people will mitigate a little bit of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming that, you know, Beyond the Bounds comes out and everyone loves it and like, yes, please give us more. And, you know, which they will. It's amazing. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Not biased at all. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Another thing no one tells you about Kickstarter is that people can back out to the last moment. Like,
yep.
It can be midnight and everyone can back out, which can be terrifying too. I mean, I didn't think that was going to happen, but that can be terrifying too, right? Like, there's always sure. that, like, worry in the back of my mind. Like, oh my God, what if literally everyone is like, no, I hate you now.
Yeah. It was more unnerving when you'd see someone put in like a fairly big chunk of cash and like, are they going to back out at the last minute? And if they are, what are we going to do?
Right. Those are the worries, I think. Well, and specifically talking about smaller publishing, independent publishing, self-publishing, having to have not even just like other hats you have to put on, like whole other outfits where it's like, I can't write today because I have to do nothing but email people. And then I have to do nothing but cross-check databases to make sure I got all the, like, you're doing more than just editing in the grand scheme. I think, especially now, like, you can not do those things if you don't want to, but generally that's going to make things a little bit harder, or you're already in a place where you don't have to worry about doing those things. You have a big name or a big following already.
Yeah.
Sort of shifting gears, specifically talking about editing the stories themselves, having those come in and knowing what you want the book to accomplish, knowing your sort of goal and what you're aiming for. How do you avoid editing a story to what you would write? How do you focus on editing a story to further support the author's voice? What are the like tools and the ways that you approach a story where you're like, okay, I'm going to make this more authentically the author, not me. How do you go about doing that?
Stephanie and I have very different editing styles. Ooh,
I'm excited then.
Yeah.
Do you want me to go first or?
You can go first. I've been taking a lot of questions. So you can go first.
Okay. So a lot of editors I know just they use comments and they're like, hey, well, like maybe this, maybe this. I am very much I go in and I am incapable of separating developmental and line edits into two different things. So it all just happens at once as I'm reading it. The way that I try and keep the authentic voice of the author is that any suggestions or changes that I make ultimately keep the same wordage that was already there. I just try and modify it to make it flow better or make more narrative sense. So I will limit myself to, I will not add anything on top of what the author has. I will simply restructure what they already have. And if a word is incorrect, I will replace the word. Or if I'm like, I'm not sure this is the word you want to use here, I'll leave a comment about it. But in general, most of the changes, and short stories are different than like, say, editing a novel. So with short stories, there really isn't much of a developmental edit usually, because if I didn't like the story, I'm not going to take the story.
Right.
If that makes sense. Whereas with a novel, you have like, well, this chunk of the story right here isn't really working out. So it is mostly line edits, like grammatical, flow, structural. And I mean, that's usually just a matter of moving things around, reorganizing sentences. And so that's just what I do, is I just go through and I just do all of that. And then, so like, I'll leave these suggestions and I will send to the author, like in the email, be like, hey, like, this is what I've done. These rephrasings are entirely my opinion. if you look at it and you agree that the line needs to be changed, but you don't like the way that I changed it, please change it yourself. But this is just me pointing out that these things are hindering the flow and structure of your story.
So Vaughn did say we have two different editing styles, but I think we have similar editing philosophies.
Yeah.
Where, like, some of editing is like, some of it is like, okay, this is a typo, fix it, right? Like,
sure, yeah.
That's fine. Right. Like, but a lot of it is subjective of, hey, I think this was a little clunky, maybe move this here and do this. And sometimes it is like, no, I intended for that to be clunky because I wanted you to be taken out of the story or something like that. And so I think what Vaughn was referring to is I can read a story 20 times to edit it just to make sure that I want to double check that A, I got caught everything I can catch, and B, that I'm not making suggestions that would take away the writer's voice. But at the end of the day, Vaughn reads a story like once, maybe twice. Did you read any stories twice?
I read them twice if the author came back with, hey, I have questions about this, or specifically wanted me to respond with, you know, like, hey, these are the edits that I made. Can you please, like, let me know if everything's okay?
Yeah.
but, I mean, part of that's just that I, because I write so much and so often, I can't do it for my own work to save my life, but anyone else's work, I can just, like, I can burn through it really quickly and sort of catch all the things. And I usually catch most of the things the first run through on people's stories.
Do you think it's because you're disconnected? Because it's not your work?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I read, and the thing is, I read my work so much that I can't even see it anymore by the time I'm done with it half the time. Yeah. Like I told Stephanie, I have this rule. I don't read any of my work after it's published because I will see all the problems. But yeah, no, I mean, I try and, cause also my thing is I know what it's like to be on the other side and, you know, dealing with editors who, are not as fast as I would prefer. I'm a very quick moving person. And so for me, part of my editing philosophy is I want to do the best job that I can while still getting these edits to the person and give them as much time as they need to rework it. So if the deadline for all the stories is 3 months out, I want to give them as close to 3 months as I can.
Yeah.
To be able to edit their story, you know? So I try and get them their stuff fairly quickly without losing any of the quality. I think I only had one or two authors point out that I like missed a spelling mistake or something that they caught after the fact. The other one was, and I think this is a really cool thing, sort of just harking back to the diversity of the anthology and how we're going to kind of open up people's eyes to new worlds with this, is I had made a change to the structure of one of the sentences in one of the stories. And the author actually came back and said, you know, the reason that this was phrased and said this way is because it's a cultural thing. You know, this is how we talk about it. And I was like, I didn't know that. So cool. Like, you know, no, definitely keep it in. Like I thought it was this. That's on me. I don't know the culture very well. You're part of that. You obviously do. So yeah, let's go with that. And that's my thing is I think none of my edits to me are hills to die on. And I think that's how I get away with, like, you know, the way that I edit. Cause even though I am changing things up for people, if they're like, I don't like the way you did this, I'm like, cool. Okay. Just, you know, yeah, make it your way, but make it not bad. You know, like that's kind of how I, how I approach things.
Yeah.
See, I think I probably would fall a little closer to you, Stephanie. I would have to read multiple times to do developmental as a different edit, line edit as a different edit. It's hard for me to keep all of those. Like if I see a typo, sure, fix the typo, but I would probably be doing multiple reads too. Why do you think, is that why? Are you trying to balance all of the things at once, or are you leaving some things for other reads?
So if I note something in a read, I'll put a note, a comment or something, but then I'll go back and try to really question it and say, was that just me thinking, like, is that how I would write it? You know, like, so I do try to make sure. I think Vaughn is maybe more removed from editing, or better at removing the writer from the editor. So I really try to make sure that no one feels like I'm trying to step over their voice or step on them or do anything like that, and also make sure that it's consistent throughout. So I'll read it and I'll make sure I like understand the narrative voice, and then I'll read it and be like, does the narrative voice actually like go through this entire story, or are there places where maybe this voice cuts off? So each time I read, I am focused on a different thing, but I can also catch other things. And like by the 20th time I read, I'm not catching anything, but it's just for my own sanity of just in case that what if I missed that typo?
Right. It is kind of strange, almost like someone handing you a pot and then being like, you work on this now. It's like, well, you did it. it's kind of strange, but when you're in the hands of a good editor, it feels pretty awesome. So it sounds like you guys brought very good mindsets and skills to the table as far as taking care of everybody's stories.
It is interesting to me just kind of hearing Stephanie's side, and all I can think of is when you're distilling alcohol, if you keep, you know, filtering it back and forth and back and forth, you get this stronger alcohol. And that's one of my concerns, is if I read the story too many times, I will slowly start to restructure it into my story.
It turns so into a Vaughn Jackson story, yeah.
Right. Huh. The first pass through, I can just sit there and I'm like, yeah, the writer in me is in the back, like, oh, thank God, words that aren't mine. And then the more I read it, he comes out and he's like, what are we doing up here? And I'm like, no, stay back there. So I have to kind of, that's how I sort of keep the writer part of me in check away from the editor part, is I just, you know, I give him some hot cocoa and tell him, go sit over there for a little bit.
Do you think those two things, the editor and the reader, do you think they're separate, or sorry, the editor and the writer, do you think they're separate from the reader? Like, if you're sitting down to read a thing, how often can you just read it? Or how often do those other parts of you come in where it's like, oh man, why'd you put a comma there? Or like, I wouldn't have done this. Commas. Yeah.
I think I'm actually pretty good at keeping all three fairly separate.
Yeah.
I mean, I do notice like, you know, spelling like typos in books or stuff like that. Not so much commas. And then, yeah, I mean, I feel like every reader has a moment when they're reading and they're like, oh, I would have done this way. Or, you know, I think that's a very common reader experience. Writer Alex wants nothing to do with what reader Alex is reading most of the time. And I think that me editing is a very specific mindset to get into. So it doesn't interfere too much with my reading process either.
Yeah. What about you, Stephanie?
For me, it depends on what I'm reading, because just like watching TV shows or watching movies, I'm a mood reader. And so sometimes I'll pick up like a book and I'll be like, I'm not reading to have my brain on. I'm not reading to read good literature. I'm reading to read this terrible book that I know is terrible that I want to read anyway. Yeah. Or maybe terrible is an unfair word, but it's not Faulkner. And so for those, I can kind of turn my brain off. A lot of times it's when I'm tired or had a long day at work or something like that. And then sometimes I've noticed it more and more. I'll be reading and I'll be like, oh, that sentence didn't quite, like, there's something wrong with that sentence. And kind of try to beat that back. Like, just enjoy it. Just
have like fun.
Just have fun.
I struggle. I'm reading a book right now by an author that I adore. I love their work. I would say that they're probably in my top 10 favorite authors, and they sometimes use ellipses so much that I'm like, why did you do? Why put another ellipses there? You don't need that.
I'm the M dash author.
The M dash author.
The M dash author. Yes.
And I hate M dashes for some reason. I don't know why. Whenever I see them, I'm like, can we get rid of that? How can we get rid of that?
It is funny, those things that stick, because for me, I most of the time with M dashes, for me, when I don't use them, it's because I can't remember the shortcut on my keyboard. So it's just like, you know what? That's a comma.
Oh, I made the mistake of setting it up so that Google Docs at least automatically perceives the two dashes side by side as an M dash and replaces it. specifically to annoy Stephanie. That's exactly why I do it. Yeah, we're gonna go with that.
I'd believe that.
No, I just, I don't like the way that, I don't like the way that commas look when you're using them to separate action from dialogue.
Yeah.
Like in the middle of action and dialogue, I think the M dashes look cleaner. Yeah.
See, I think they have their place, but don't go wild.
They do have their place.
Don't get wild out here with the M dashes.
If I'm editing Vaughn's work, I cross out a lot of M dashes.
Yeah.
I will say the only writer I will be like brutally ruthless with edits is Vaughn, probably.
She's so mean to me.
I think that makes sense, though. Knowing the level, like, knowing that you can say to someone, like, you gotta fix this. And having it be, I mean, you obviously don't want to be mean, but being able to be like, come on.
Yeah.
You can do better than this.
Yeah.
It's funny, because that's exactly she actually left that comment to me on one of my drafts. It's just, she just pointed to a section and was just like, you're better than this. And I was like, okay, moving on. We're going to come back to that one when I'm not crying.
Yeah, simultaneously, else, thank you, but ouch.
With everyone else, I feel like I really try. Another thing I do when I go over edit, I will go over my own edits to make sure they aren't mean.
Yeah.
And make sure they are nice. Because I want to make I don't give Vaughn that necessarily, that pass-through.
Sure.
Yeah.
It was interesting because Stephanie and I, for the anthology, we literally just split the stories basically in half.
Yeah.
To edit them, except for my story. So I think Stephanie ended up with one more story to edit than I did. And I remember seeing the comments that she was leaving to people on their stories. And when she edited my story, the comments I got back were nothing like the
where did
the
that kind, other person go?
I was like where did the kind gentle editor for all these other stories go?
I think you're like, you can edit like this. I didn't know that. I didn't know you could be nice.
I was pretty surprised.
Wrapping up now, one thing that I've thought about a lot, I'm sure both of you have as well, since you're both writing and editing, titling a story.
I hate it.
Yeah. So this is one of the reasons why I was like, I know that it's kind of a big divide. You're either a fan or you're not. And getting stories to come in from an open call specifically, as well as stories that you've commissioned from some other authors. How has the titling worked for this specific anthology? Because what do you do? Like, do you put a little bitty like foreshadow in the title? Is it a cheeky title? Is it totally inscrutable and will make sense? Or maybe it doesn't make sense at all. Like, where do you fall on the scale of titling and how did these stories get their titles?
So we just ran with whatever the authors titled the stories. Obviously, I think there had been anything like egregious.
Sure.
You know, if we received a cosmic horror story that was like, you know, like Barney's Big Adventure or something, I might have suggested changing it.
Sure.
But what if, in general,
what if Barney was in it?
Yeah, maybe Barney it works. In it,
what if it was like Barney's Big Cosmic Adventure?
I don't want to fight Barney's lawyers.
I mean, that's a broad enough name. But if it's a purple dinosaur, that's where, you know.
He was green with a purple stomach. But we just kind of ran with the titles that the authors had. Stephanie, you're gonna have to make sure you get this one right. But I think my favorite title that we had in the story is "In the House There Were Teeth and There Were Eyes," or is it the other way around? Eyes and There Were Teeth.
No, that's correct. You got it right. Oh hell yeah! I always say eyes and teeth. It's a really good title.
I was gonna say that's a badass title.
Yeah, and like, because it tells you something about the story, but not what you think you know about the story. And so it was just one of those things where I was like, this is fucking awesome.
Yeah, that's a good title. Yeah. And it sounds like it maybe ties in with that cover that I saw on Raw Dog Screaming Press's website. That cover is righteous.
It is. That cover. So good.
Yeah.
And Lynn Hansen, fantastic. And it is. I'm glad that you picked up on that, because I pretty much gave her that story title. Jen gave it to her from me, that like story title, as like a basis for what I wanted the cover to look like.
Yeah.
So
that cover, I mean, we had an idea of what we wanted it to look like, but neither of us are artists, and I told Lynn, we saw her over the weekend, and I was like, I just could not have imagined how good this would turn out and how amazing this would be.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We're not authors, we're not artists, and we're so much not artists that I'd like to do little like mock-ups for like my own covers. And so I did like this little mock-up for what I kind of thought the cover would look like for this. And I gave it to Jen and I was like, you know, you can give this to Lynn if you think it would help. And she goes, I'll give her the words that you said. I was like, okay. Taken.
I'll give her 5% of this. That's a good job, man. That's a good work.
Basically.
And I'll hang it on the fridge. Along with the macaroni art.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting to know none of the titles changed. It actually makes me feel good to know that you guys were just like, oh yeah, I mean, these titles all work. So
yeah, I mean, they all the titles fit. That's great. That was actually really great, because honestly, if I had to like help authors come up with titles for their stories, I might have, you know, can I run another Kickstarter instead, please?
And then Beyond the Bounds of Infinity comes from a Lovecraft quote, actually, just to make him feel great about.
Really ram it up in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the quote is, I have seen beyond the bounds of infinity and drawn down demons from the stars. I have harnessed the shadows that stride from world to world to sow death and madness. So it's pretty good.
All good things to aspire to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, as much of a shithead as he was, that is a pretty good quote.
Gotta love it. Gotta love it while you hate it, right?
Yep, yeah. That's true. I appreciate both of you coming on and chatting about the book. Beyond the Bounds of Infinity is up for pre-order right now on Raw Dog Screaming Press's website. It's coming out July 10th, 2024. If you're listening to this after that date, what are you waiting for? Go grab this book. Thank you both so much for chatting. This is awesome.
Of course, this was great. I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
This is great. Thank you so much.
That was my chat with Vaughn A. Jackson and Stephanie Paris, the editors of Beyond the Bounds of Infinity, an anthology coming out July 10th, 2024 from Raw Dog Screaming Press, a collection of H.P. Lovecraft-inspired fiction by marginalized voices. Make sure you check it out. Make sure you tell me what you thought about it, what you thought about the show. Share it with your friends. I always appreciate hearing what people think about the show. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time.